Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions' world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. 2022 has been a great year for original horror films, in theaters and beyond. Yes, there are always franchises, Halloween Ends, Scream, Hellraiser, Prey, and the other perennials. But for years, we've been decrying the death of originals, especially on the big screen, where we can share our horrific experience with an eager crowd, because, as we often say here, horror is best and most effective shared. It has been a rich and surprising abundance of wealth, primarily in the independent world. But when the studios have found that originals can and do work in theaters as well as on their streaming platforms, all bets are off. Take Ty West, as his double play of X and Pearl are shining examples, soon to be joined by a third chapter. Now add Barbarian, Bodies, 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 Nope, Watcher, Something in the Dirt, Hatching, The Menu, The Black Phone, and you've got a formidable year for our dark genre. And then there's Smile. Based on his short film, Laura Hasn't Slept, writer-director Parker Finn's Smile was originally intended for streaming, but found its way to the big screen and has grossed $200 million globally as of now. This is a huge achievement and will hopefully secure the studio's interest in giving us new and original stories to tell in our local cineplexes. Parker is our guest today, and we'll learn all about that long and winding road that led to such a huge box office success on his first time out. After this, never trust a smile again. The hit horror movie Smile is now streaming on Paramount Plus. After witnessing a bizarre traumatic incident involving a patient, Dr. Rose Cotter starts experiencing frightening occurrences that she cannot explain. As an overwhelming terror begins taking over her life, Rose must confront her troubling past in order to survive and escape her horrifying new reality. How far will Rose go to find out what's behind a smile? Sosie Bacon stars in Smile, now streaming on Paramount Plus. Rated R. Head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Welcome. It's great to have you here, Parker.
Thank you. It's amazing to be here.
Well, how does a guy go from Bath, Ohio, to a $200 million grossing horror studio horror movie? Where did that start? I know you went to film school in L.A., but how did that transition from small town Ohio lead you to Hollywood?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was slowly but surely, you know, growing up in northern Ohio, I was a fan of movies from a young age. My dad was a cinephile and got me into, watching everything. I was watching rated R movies when I was way too young.
And not just genre films, but a wide panoply of films.
A wide range of stuff, but definitely there was a lot of genre films. I mean, he loved, like, you know, war films and Western films, but he also definitely got me into genre as well, because he was a fan of special effects and and, you know, that sort of immediately sort of carried over to me. And I
hear that Poltergeist changed your life.
Yeah, big time. I mean, Poltergeist scared me so badly as a kid. You know, I have so much love for that movie, but I mean, there's just so many scenes in that film that are really traumatizing for, like, you know, a young boy back when, you know, I feel like everybody's so overexposed to everything now because of the internet, but, you know, back when I was growing up, you know, the only chance to see something like that was in a movie, and it yeah, there's just so many traumatizing scenes in that film. And it's also like the fact that it's like rated PG is like ridiculous, which I know is part of, I think, of when it was released. But
it was right before the PG-13 rating became a reality, also through Steven Spielberg and the second Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I grew up loving horror films. My mom also, you know, was... she had been a school teacher and was very big on reading. So I also always had a book in my hand.
Oh, that's great.
So sort of I had both going on at the same time. But when you're growing up in like Northern Ohio as a kid back, you know, I was born in the 80s, growing up in the 90s. You know, I feel like movies just sort of feel like this fully formed thing that's like handed down from above. You know, you're not really thinking about like how they get made or where they come from. They just sort of feel like, you know, pure intention. And so I think like when I was a kid, I kind of, you know, I wanted to be like, you know, Harrison Ford. I wanted to be Indiana Jones and Han Solo and all those things, because like that's what I saw, right? And I didn't understand that somebody was like authoring these films until at a certain point, you know, it was the, you know, certainly with like, you know, the Terminator films, I think the Alien films, and Jurassic Park, where I started to realize like, oh, they're like authors behind these things, you know? And that I was like, that seems like the most amazing job in the world. And you know, that sort of became like an obsession for me. But when you're in Ohio as a kid, it's like, you know, Hollywood might as well be, you know, on Pluto. Like it's not there's no like direct, like obvious route to get there. So yeah, I had been, you know, I started writing at a very young age and, had, you know,
how
always,
old?
I mean, I think I was writing my first stuff when I was, I don't know, maybe like 9 or 10. I mean, like just like, you know, garbage, but like,
but you were writing movies or you were writing short stories?
Just short stories. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I started that at 12.
I had no idea like what a screenplay even looked like, but I was also making, you know, little movies and stuff like on like my dad's camcorder, you know, just like editing in camera. And like, you know, I remember realizing the first time that I'm like, oh, if I like press pause and I like move and go over here and shoot from another angle, it's like, you know, it's an edit. It's like a movie, you know? And
so you were teaching yourself the construction of movies.
Yeah. I mean, in a weird way, it felt like it was all sort of just like, I was teaching myself, but I didn't even realize I was doing it. Just sort of instinctually, I was like, oh, this is like, this now feels like a movie. And whether I was doing things with friends or with like action figures or whatever I was doing, you know, it was just a way, it was just endlessly fascinating to me. Eventually, I went to undergrad at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and I was an English creative writing major.
Wow, that's a great school and a great town to be in.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and it's you know, Boulder's a very, very fun, exciting place to be. It's the school is great, and it was, you know, I was writing all the time there, and I had some couple of like short stories that were published, and I knew I wanted to be a storyteller, but you know, I think film was always my absolute favorite medium.
What years did you go to the university?
I graduated University of Colorado in 2009.
Ah, okay.
And you know, I got a lot of encouragement coming out of some of those like fiction workshops and stuff that I had been in. But it's also, you know, it's like, it's one of those things too, where you're at a point in your life, you're like, you know, like you're definitely at a fork in the road. Like, do I want to go like get a safe career and make money? Or, you know, do I want to do this thing that like I'm, you know, that's all I think about and all I want to do. And
what was the safe career you considered?
I mean, you know, there I looked at things like, do I want to go into finance or law school or do, you know.
Something practical.
Yeah, something that the world, you know, like needs, you yeah. know, like that is, you know, trying to, you know, put something into the world. Because I think, you know, for the longest time, it feels like you can just be shouting into the void and you're like, yeah, does anybody care? Does this matter at all?
Yeah.
Or am I just being very selfish? I don't know. but yeah. And so then as I was, you know, getting close to graduating, I sort of made the decision that I, you know, wanted to see if I could get into graduate film school out in California. And I ended up going to Chapman University and did a 2-year master's program there, which was great. It got me to move out to Southern California and to, you know, it's sort of like that was the, I took the fork in the road that was going to lead towards filmmaking, hopefully. And yeah, and, you know, you it's funny, you show up at a film school and like suddenly, you know, everybody around you like just wants to talk movies
right.
and directors and storytellers.
They all want to do what you're.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas like for the vast majority of your life, you know, like you're trying to talk about movies to other people and they're like, yeah, well, I don't care, man.
You know? Yeah. Did you have friends when you were a kid who were into it or you really felt like you were on an island?
I definitely had friends that were into movies, but just only in like a, they loved watching them, but like that's about, you know, where it stopped.
In a mainstream sense.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I spent a lot of time in the video store as a kid, like, yeah. you know, perusing the aisles and, you know, looking at box art and reading the backs. And I used to always like, I mean, I loved the horror section, it was my favorite, but I used to like scare myself with the box art before I'd ever even seen the film. And I'd be like imagining what the movie was about. And like, you know, oftentimes what was in my head was way scarier than what eventually the movie ended up being.
Unfortunately, often the case.
Yeah, for sure. But
so
man,
what were the ones that excited you in your youth when you were discovering?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have like, for me, I sort of feel like there's a time before and a time after seeing A Nightmare on Elm Street for the first time. That for me was one of the scariest concepts I'd ever seen in my life. I'm sort of, there's something about, things that feel inevitable, you know, or like impossible to stop or prevent that really gets under my skin. And I felt like, you know, I watched it at a friend's house, like at a sleepover for the first time. And I remember like the movie ended and like everybody else was like, all right, what are we going to do for the rest of the night? Should we like, you know, play video games or whatever. And I was like, wait, guys, like, how are we just moving on from this movie? Like, I was absolutely terrified by it. I feel like I didn't sleep for a week after that because I was so freaked out by it. John Carpenter's The Thing. You know, I've been obsessed with practical special effects all my life. And I had just never experienced anything like that.
Nobody had.
Yeah. Rob Bottin's work on that film, which, you know, I mean, obviously it's been so discussed to death. There's nothing I can really add to the conversation, but that, you know, I just the fact that like, man, the amount of movie magic that was used to disturb and unsettle an audience. I'd never seen anything like that before.
I was lucky enough to be on the set doing the making of.
Oh, man.
And to be watching, you gotta be fucking kidding me.
Yeah, that is so incredible. So lucky. Wow.
It was great.
Yeah.
So how important do you think it is for a young, hopeful filmmaker to make that move to Los Angeles?
You know, it's hard to say. So I think that if you can make it work in your life, it's 100% worth it to do it because, you know, there's something in the air in Los Angeles that I think it sort of forces you to like confront the thing you came out here to do. It's very hard to put it out of mind because everyone around you is also sort of chasing the thing that they came out to do. And it's a constant topic of conversation. So it can be incredibly motivating. I think it can also be incredibly demotivating to some people to be out here. So it's a bit of a toss up and, you know, it's a ridiculously expensive city. So you have to be like willing to, you know, maybe live in a shoebox in the valley, if,
yeah.
you know, if that's sort of what your situation is. But, you know, there is something very, there's still something magic, I think, about being out here that is important. I mean, people can make films anywhere and with, you know, everything, all modern technology and how we're all interconnected.
Like, and meetings are all online and Zoom calls, yeah, and all that stuff.
Exactly. But there is something to be said about the connections that you'll organically make out here. I mean, nobody wants to, like, I think, like, people always talk about, like, networking and stuff, which I don't think actually exists. I think that, like, you know, relationships are the real thing, that are formed organically, and your peers and the people that you're coming up with, and even, you know, people that become assistants in town. You know, like, I remember so many of the people that I went to school with, you know, they are doing different things in the industry, and they're, like, some of my really good friends. And it's just, you know, having formed those relationships early on is really important when you're out here and finding your community, your sort of...
And, like, it's where the industry lives.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's worth it, but I don't think it's 100% necessary. You know, right. People got to figure that out for their
I was lives. Lucky enough to be born here. So that helped a lot. So tell me about the film school experience. Suddenly you have the equipment and the tools of filmmaking at your beck, and you're able to do that. So how was that experience for you? And tell me, did it start with writing? Did it move into actually doing assignments where you're shooting something?
Yeah. So I applied and got into the screenwriting MFA program. Hmm. The what was great about Chapman is that you pick a specialty, but there's an opportunity to try everything there. So I was crewing on other people's sets. You know, I directed some shorts. There was always, if you're like, you know, you can make as many sort of opportunities as you want to in film school. I really think that, you know, film school's, again, not 100% necessary for anybody to get into the industry, and, you know, can be, you know, very expensive with things like loans and stuff like that. But I think you can get out of it what you put into it. And I think that the you know, that environment and the connections that you make was really huge for me. You know, it really got me to start taking it seriously, and to just, like, you know, that's what sort of started me making a go at it.
Well, surrounded by people who are all eager to attain careers in this field had to be motivating and exciting, and just such a change from being in Bath, Ohio.
Big time. And it also, like, I mean, listen, film school is not the industry. And I do think that, like, a lot of schools would benefit from, I don't know how you do it, but giving students a little bit more of a dose of reality,
the
of
real
the
world, and a schedule where you've got to be in this location at this time and out of it by here, and
you and can't the business pick up side of things, and how just sort of, you know, I mean, which a lot of it is hard to do until you're actually in it and doing it, but I will say it gets you to it gives you at least an access point of, like, okay, this is how something gets developed, gets prepped, gets made, you know, goes through the post thing, and then, like, what do you do with it afterwards? Which is, like, you know, I mean, you could find a way to, like, get ahead of the curve elsewhere on your own and do that. But I think that it's a really great, like, practical, hands-on way to learn, like, how do you take something from an idea to, like, getting it into a film festival.
Right. And you also have professional equipment to work with at your hands that would be an expensive rental otherwise.
For sure. And I think the schools, very smartly, they don't just sort of, you don't just show up and they unlock access to all of that right away, which I think would be a huge mistake. You know, I think, like, I remember, you know, when we first got there, they're like, here's a mini DV camera. You don't get anything else. Go make something and then show it to your peers, you know, which is, like, that's the other big thing too, is, you know, screening in front of, you know, your sort of your contemporaries in school with you. Everybody sits there and watches everybody's projects back to back to back to back. And, like, you know, everybody raises their hands and talks about them right afterwards. And, like, that can be, you know, that is a, that can be a rough ride, but it's, I think it's a really necessary one to like have people, you know, sit there and sort of point out everything wrong with your project right in front of you.
And these are potential filmmakers who are giving input, as opposed to all your best friends and family who are going to love everything you do.
Exactly. And because of the competitive nature in film school, you know, I think people, they'll dig in even more. But again, that's like nothing compared to what's going to happen with when you put a movie out in the world for real. So
what was the next step after film school? I mean, finding an agent is obviously incredibly important if you want access to the industry. Was that your next step, and how did you go about it?
So, you know, after school, so Chapman's down in the city of Orange, which is, you know, about like 35 miles south of LA, which is actually a great location because you have, you know, access to LA, but you also get to be a little bit removed from it.
Yes.
Moved up to LA. I moved into a house with like five other friends that I graduated with.
All filmmaker, hopeful filmmakers.
Yeah. And you know, and it was the like by far and away the cheapest rent I ever paid in LA. It was great. I mean, we lived in that house for a couple of years, and I have a lot of nostalgia for it. And some of those guys are still some of my best friends. That's the thing. I mean, you graduate from film school and then you go to LA and you're like, okay, like, now what? Like nothing is waiting for you here.
And nobody at film school is saying, here, I know this agent that you should talk to or anything like that.
I mean, there might be some of that going on, but like
that didn't
happen for me. No. Yeah. I had been working as an assistant in town for a little bit.
What companies?
For a few different companies, but I,
we'll leave it at that. Yeah.
I was a terrible assistant. It was, you know, partly just 'cause I'm not wired that way. And partly because, you know, I was thinking about the stuff that I wanted to do all the time. Right. And when you're an assistant this town, I mean, you are really dedicated to somebody else's schedule and
24 hours a day.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I did that for a while, and then eventually I was like, I don't have enough time to do the creative stuff that I want to do. So I quit and then figured out ways to make it work with day jobs for several years, right? But I had time to be writing, and then, you know, I was spending time where I could scrapping together short films with like, you know, mostly with like no budget, you know, just trying to like wrangle some friends together, having a really strong idea for something and a plan, and then like wrangling friends together on a weekend to shoot it. And then, you know, seeing them through in post. And so I spent a lot of years just kind of grinding, writing features, writing shorts, and like making a short here and there where I could. And I, you know, I had a couple of scripts that like got passed around town, and like, you know, I would get the occasional like water bottle meeting off of them, but you know, none of them ever went the distance, or really, you know, nothing ever really happened with any of that stuff. And
so you sent them by yourself? You didn't go through an agent at this time?
No, I mean, I sort of like worked with some like managers here and there that like for like short periods of time, that, you know, but like nothing ever came to fruition with any of that.
Right.
And you know, there's a whole lot of people sort of like telling you what you should do, and like, oh, you should write something like this. And I'm like, I didn't come out here to write something like that. And they're like, well, you shouldn't write that thing you want to write, which, and I was like, all of that was like not, didn't feel correct to me. And I think like, you know, so I decided a certain,
because everybody else is writing what they should be writing. You should write something of your own that's distinctive to who you are as a creative person.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's very easy, I think, especially, you know, for young writers that are trying to find a way to break in, to like, try to like, you know, game theory the industry or like sort of scheme their way and like write towards some objective.
Yeah, if you're writing something that's popular now, it's going to be out of fashion by the time you finish.
Yeah, and there's just, you know, I think there's a whole like kind of like bizarre cottage industry around aspiring screenwriters.
Boy, that's for sure.
Very, very strange that I don't get at all. But, you know, for me, I think what was like really important was sort of the decision to just like, you know, take the wheel on my own sort of path. And so I made a couple of short films, and then I there was this one that I, you know, I wanted to take a swing on a short film. You know, I had done a couple that were basically for no money. I had one of the ones that I had put out into the world had done really well on the festival circuit, and I made that for basically for the price of of food. and so, you know, I had been writing these sort of stacks of short films, and I knew like there was a few that were, that felt like bigger swings. And I kept sort of, you know, trying to figure out which one it was going to be. And so there was this one that I'd written called Laura Hasn't Slept. And, that was the one I decided to pull the trigger on. And it, you know, it was the first time that like I raised a little bit of money sort of internally. So like friends and family and stuff like that. And then I opened like a couple of new credit cards with like no interest for 18 months, which is not something I recommend anybody do. Yeah. unless you're like, you know, really, really sure you want to do it. And I just sort of, you know, I covered my eyes and just, you know, was expensing things on those cards. And, you know, I was able to sort of like talk my way into a soundstage, and we, wow. we did a lot of prep and planning for this. We had, you know, basically 5 days to build and light the set, and then we had 2 days to shoot. And then
where was the stage?
So it was at Chapman.
Okay.
And I was an alumni at that point.
And how many people were on your crew?
For that crew, I think about 20 people. And again, it was mostly friends. You know, I like every favor I had ever banked, you know, I sort of called on for that because I'd worked on other people's sets and just whatever I could do over the years. And so, and I, you know, give a lot of credit to all my friends and collaborators on that who really came through it. And, you know, we kept it to a 2 day shoot. And so, you know, we shot that film, which was like, you know, it was a much bigger swing. I mean, it's still a very modest budget, but like, you know, we put some actual money into it. I took on some debt to do that.
Yeah. What was the budget, if you want to say? If you don't, that's okay too.
It was close to about 30.
Oh, that's great.
Which, you know, felt
like... It's a healthy
like...
budget for a short, but it also, you're competing with all the other professional filmmaking out there, not with other students.
Yeah. And that felt like an insane amount of money at the time to me that I was very nervous about, but, you know, I had committed to doing it and like, you know, so, but we did the short, I shot it and then we got into post, and because it was like me and, you know, just a couple of friends working on it in post sort of like in the evenings. Cause like we had like almost no money for post on the short, but wanted to make sure it was done correctly. So, you know, it took months and months to finish that. Cause there's visual effects, there's like real sound design, you know, we, you know, did an original score for it. We managed to get it into South by Southwest for its
premiere.
Yeah, well,
you need to make it a real movie and not feel like an amateur short.
Yeah, which is something that I had done on my previous short films, was like, you know, that was a big, I think, thing that I learned early on, is that like seeing a short through in post is like so important, and making sure that you're finishing it you know, correctly makes such a huge difference, no matter how long it takes to do that. And we had gotten the short into South by Southwest. It was supposed to have its world premiere there in 2020. That was supposed to be March 2020.
Oh no.
Yeah. And so we found out like the week beforehand that it was canceled because of the onset of the pandemic, which was brutal. You know, I had a lot of emotional eggs invested in the basket of
premiere. Oh, you had to be looking forward to this like nothing ever before.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, but again, like very, very small potatoes problems compared to what was going on in the world. So like, you know, I certainly wasn't, I was very frustrated internally, but I wasn't, you know, it didn't feel like anybody wanted to hear about that. But luckily, because they had canceled the festival so close to its date, they went ahead with the judging and
they did it online. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Laura Hasn't Slept, was so lucky to win, the special jury award. And that got like announced in all the trades, like in, you know, Deadline and everywhere else.
Right.
And so we had this Vimeo link with a password on it that got like slipped out.
Oops.
And which
that was the best thing in the world.
Yeah,
for you, right?
And I remember like I woke up one morning and suddenly there were like hundreds of new views on it, and I was like, wait, what is going on right now? And so I heard that like it was being passed around town, like very, you know, I guess organically, like people were just sharing it. And
because they liked it. Yeah.
And I, you know, but I was sort of like, I don't think anybody knew how to get a hold of me. So I went to the Vimeo page and like made an edit on it and like put my email on the page.
Smart.
And then like the next day, like my inbox exploded. Which was very, it was a very weird, surreal way to start the pandemic because, suddenly I was on like 10 Zooms a day. I'd never used Zoom, but I think most of us hadn't, but suddenly
yeah.
It instantly became my life from my, I was living in a very small, one bedroom guest house. And at the time,
I wish you didn't have five roommates in there with you.
No, just the one, but you know, just from my bedroom, suddenly it felt like I was having meetings all across town. And so I was able to, that was how I signed with my agent and managers.
So people look for these things, you know, that they look at the competitions of the well-established festivals and they're looking for talent.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, there's also a sense of like, you know, I heard from people that like, you know, the short film hit their inbox from like five different trusted people on
right.
the same day, you know? So I felt like,
yeah.
like it seemed like they were like, well, I can't not watch this, you know, which was very exciting that happened. But, you know, all of the producers and executives and people that I was talking to, everybody seemed very hungry for a feature. And they were curious if I had a feature sort of based on this short. And when I made the short, I made it to exist for its own right. I think the best shorts feel sort of self-contained.
Yeah,
I think
yeah, complete.
And anything that sort of like smells like a commercial for something bigger, I think oftentimes feels a little cynical. And
yeah.
like, you know, I've seen a bunch of those. They never quite work for me. I think you want to feel like real passion for what the short itself is.
Absolutely, that it is self-contained. But
yeah.
So it wasn't your idea to turn that into a feature, or it was, do you have a feature and thought that maybe this could be the one?
Yeah, well, when I was in post on that short, because I was in post on it for so long, you know, there was something about the idea that sort of like kept, you know, poking around inside of my brain, that felt like there's something more here, you know, with the tone and the sort of circumstances of the short. And slowly but surely this you know idea for a much larger story emerged from that, for what eventually became Smile. And so I had been thinking about that and sort of brainstorming on that for quite a while. And so when people started asking, I sort of softly started pitching this idea I had been working on. And like right away, everybody was like, oh man, like that is really interesting. Like, have you written it yet? What's going on? And I was like, well, I haven't written it yet, but you know, I've got the story. And so I sort of took a couple weeks and developed a pitch for the feature, and then had this opportunity to via Zoom pitch it all around town.
Right.
And
so was it produced first before Paramount Plus picked it up, or they funded the writing of the script and the making of the film?
So yeah, Paramount bought, like they basically they wanted to do it based on the pitch. So what they did was they you know, they optioned the short film and then got me going writing the first draft. And
right, so it was an all-in-one house. It wasn't like assembling 20 different production companies like
exactly.
so many films
yeah.
do.
It was just my producers at Temple Hill, who were amazing, who like really believed in the idea and wanted to do it the way that I wanted to do it. And so yeah, and then you know we were sort of off to the races once that deal happened. And so I wrote a draft and turned it in, and it went over really well with the studio. And then, you know, I think, you know, I had done, I think, a single round of notes, and then in May 2021, We got on a Zoom with Paramount, and they're like, hey, we're greenlit. Like, let's go make this thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you got to know that that's not the way it normally happens.
Yeah, I've been told, yes. No, I think I got very lucky with the needle that we threaded on this one, that you know, there seemed like there was all this sort of inertia behind it to get it made. But you know, we were under what was called at the time Paramount Players, which was like a sister division.
Right, they were their kind of not art house, but the smaller film division.
Yeah, and they could do original films. You know, they didn't have to be based on anything, and they were willing to take like a little bit more of like a risk on like what the things were, and they just had to fit into a certain budget box. And so we made the film under Paramount Players for Paramount Plus.
It was always intended to be streamed on Paramount Plus.
Yes. Yeah, so that was the whole situation of how we got greenlit was for that. So we were off to the races. We had a, you know, very like tight prep time.
How long?
So we had 6 weeks, and we only...
Oh my God.
And we only had one role cast, which was Sosie.
Right.
So it was...
And we'll talk about the casting process in a bit.
But. And so it was very fast, and then we had a 31-day shoot. And
wow.
So, you know, we went out to New Jersey to do all of that, and, you know, it was under full COVID protocols.
How was New Jersey chosen?
So... I mean, I'm not going to lie. It was for the tax credit.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
But
they had the most advantageous
It was situation. A combination of, you know, the only way this movie was going to happen was through a tax credit. And we were looking at the different places. And New Jersey had everything that the script sort of called for. And what I liked about it was that there was, like, interesting like texture to it that I felt like hadn't been overshot, I don't think, in films yet. I mean, I feel like you know, Atlanta is an amazing hub for film, and I think the industry is so lucky to have Atlanta, but like everything shoots there now,
you know?
So like it's starting to like you see a lot of the same stuff happening.
It's the American Vancouver.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is to not deny like any reason to shoot in Atlanta,
but
you know,
have so many crews, you can only go so deep.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause like, if you're not $100 million Marvel movie, like, you know,
you're not getting the top of the line.
Certainly not. Yeah. So,
but in New Jersey, you can draw from New York,
which
and all
is
of the
exactly
talent.
What we did. Oh, yeah. And I just, you know, we made the decision to shoot New Jersey for New Jersey. And, you know, I love that. I love that, you know, and it's not overwhelming, but it plays a character in the film. And New Jersey in the fall is amazing. You know, it you know, there's like the industrial side of it, but it's also called the Garden State for a reason. You know, I mean, like the nature there is very interesting, and it had everything we needed. And, you know, it was awesome shooting there. I really, really enjoyed it.
So tell me about the prep, how you prepared your first feature film as a director and as a writer. Did you storyboard? Did you shot list everything? And did you go to those locations and photograph them and map them out and do all that? What was your preparation like?
Yeah, so I am I lean very, very heavy on prep. Prep is probably one of my favorite parts of the process. Mm. And, you know, even in the way that I write, I mean, I sort of write towards how I'm going to direct a scene. And sometimes, I mean, it's written specifically in the script in a way that doesn't like disrupt the flow of the read, but like that you really get a sense of like how shots are going to feel. Because I'm somebody that like, I don't like shooting standard coverage. It just, it's not the way I want to make movies. If I can do something that feels sort of like one bespoke shot into the next, you know, that's the way I want to do it. But the only way to do that is to have a really solid plan.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I shot list the entire script ahead of time, and worked on it
beforehand. You didn't do it on the weekends before each.
Correct. I mean, you're continuing to work on it.
You're
all
refining
the way through
it.
Refining. Yes. But, you know, major plan going in. And so I had been, you know, shot listing and then working on it with my DP, Charlie Saroff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, really building this plan. And then for some of the locations that we had access to in prep, we would go on, you know, you're prepping all week long. And then on the weekends we would go, and if we could get access to it, he and I would go and sort of like block things out and use our phones and sort of, you know, continue to refine. And so, you know, we're doing all of that. I mean, it, and it's the movie is like not contained, you know, which is, yeah. is it's, it, which was by design, you know, to feel like, I always feel like you should really stretch a budget to its breaking point and always be punching above your weight.
And you're living in a world then, not in a room.
Exactly. Yeah. And I sort of, you know, I do that, I think hopefully from like every angle, you know, on the film. But we had a lot to figure out because, you know, I also like, I wanted to use practical effects. Yeah. I wanted to use practical fire. You know, we knew we needed to build a couple of the locations. I love stagecraft and building sets. I'm it's like one of my favorite things in the world. And, you know, we had found this warehouse in Kearney, New Jersey. That was not a soundstage. I mean, like the lightest gust of wind and the whole thing would rattle. And it's ridiculous.
Yes, of course.
But it was a huge empty space that, you know, we could build a scene shop, and we built the interior of the hospital and the interior of Rose's childhood home, which we knew like those. And then we also did a couple other like small things that were like sort of like single shots and things like that in there. But, you know, those were locations we knew we were going to have to build. So we had to figure out all of that. We're location scouting for everything else. And you know, there was certainly, some, I would say resistance about things like practical effects and practical fire. Yeah. And you know, for me, those were very, very important.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had to make a case, and to the studio's credit, they, you know, they went with it.
You want your cast to be reacting to something they're actually in a room with rather than a green tennis ball.
Totally. Yeah. And for me, it's the stuff that I love, you know, it's like, these are the things that inspire me about movies is I love handcrafted things that are real.
Yeah.
Putting, I mean, and by the way, there's also, you know, VFX is a like marvelous tool that
fantastic.
I think is very useful that I use in my films, but I always want the combination of the two because I think that's the best way to sort of immerse an audience into what's happening on screen.
Well, you use the word tool, and that's what it is. You
yeah.
use the best tool for the effect you're going for.
It is a tool. It also is. I mean, these are real artists too that are doing amazing
yeah.
things. I don't want to discredit any of that. But that I think that blend is so important. And so we needed, you know, all of the runway, you know, through prep and production to be able to do, you know, the big giant practical effect at the end of the film
yeah.
and also the fire and all those sorts of things. Those were what we shot very, very last because we needed all that runway.
Well, film school was great in your case because you studied screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
You study in the course of production, you're doing photography, you're doing sets, you're doing sound, you're doing all the post-production is all covered. So you were really prepared to make your first time stand as a feature filmmaker.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that anything can truly prepare you for going into
yes,
that
for the
first
real
feature.
World of filmmaking.
Yeah. And you know, but I would say like going through film school and then also doing my own independent shorts, you know, that I think the discipline you learn of how important every aspect of it is and how to sort of plan out sort of the, you know, starting with a kernel of an idea to like, I've got a DCP now of a film, you know, that is invaluable, like really understanding what it takes. I think too many people are willing to be like, I'm going to shoot something on my phone on a weekend and then
yeah.
I'm going to cut it together, you know, on Monday. And then I'm just going to put it on YouTube on Tuesday,
right,
which
right.
is fine. And by the way, like, I don't mean to like, you know,
millions of those.
Yeah. And people really make it work too. And
yeah.
I'm not trying to say, but like, for me, it was really important to like understand, okay, like how do you really give every element of the film? It's like, you know, the love and time and dedication that's due to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could never have afforded film school, but fortunately, Amazing Stories was my film school.
Yeah, well.
I got to work with all of these amazing incredible. People my first time out.
Yeah.
But I started later, you know, I was in my 30s when that happened. So.
Oh, well.
But, you know, the casting process during pre-production. So how did, like, Sosie Bacon, and how did she come to your attention?
Yeah. So I had been meeting with different actors for the lead role, and I met with a lot of really incredible women that I would have been so lucky to work with. And, you know, when I met with Sosie, I had just watched Mare of Easttown. It was like really, really fresh in my brain. And I thought she was incredible in that show. I mean, she's playing this character who is, you know, sort of set up as the, you know, a heel to Kate Winslet's character, mm-hmm. Tamara. And, you know, when you're first introduced to her, you're just like, oh man, like this character feels like a villain in a way, you know, or a real antagonist, I should say, right. Not a villain, but an antagonist, right? Who is a massive roadblock to our main character. And then as it progresses, the like depth of humanity and empathy that she built into that character and that performance draws you in, and suddenly this character that you assumed you were like, you didn't want to spend any time around, suddenly you're like, wow, I'm like really fascinated and drawn to this character and really feel for her. And you know, it's a tough character. She's like a, you know, sort of like ex drug addict who's really been dealing with that, who, you know, is sort of set up as this huge kind of like mess, almost like kind of a monster. And then you to humanize a character like that is like no easy thing to do. And she's really only in, I think, like, I don't know, 9 or 10 scenes throughout the whole series, but has this massive impact on it. Yeah. And really, like, you know, is, you know, she's acting across Kate Winslet, who is Kate Winslet, right?
Yes.
But like Sosie is incredible. Yeah. You know, I mean, she has got such gravitas to her. And so when I met with her, she was just instantly saying all of the right things. It was very clear that the way that she was thinking about story and character was so thoughtful, so mature, so such an interesting approach. And she was talking about how she was really drawn to finding a role that would really challenge her and scare her. And, you know, she wasn't looking to play, you know, she wasn't like looking to put on fancy dresses and quip, you know, like.
Yeah, she's not a glamour. You cast someone who from the real world rather than someone for their glamour.
Exactly. And like, you know, I think, you know, Sosie, by the way, can do glamour really well, you know,
sure.
Which, you know,
well, but, she has good genes
for sure. But I think what she was interested in was what I was interested in. And then the fact that she had never been the lead of a feature before, there was something about that really intrigued me. I thought like there was maybe an opportunity to sort of put, you know, somebody who most audiences might not be familiar with right away in front of the camera and sort of center a story on them. And I thought that there would just be this level of like, you could suspend your disbelief even further because
yeah, you see the character, not the actor.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, right when we got off of that first meeting, you know, the first thing I did was like write a letter to the studio, and I was like, "We found Rose. Like this, it has to be Sosie," and they believed in it. I think you know, they were very intrigued by it, and so we cast Sosie, and then we were off to the races.
Yeah. So what is it that's so disconcerting about a smile?
I mean, you know, here's the thing: is that, you know, I think the sort of like obvious answer is the sort of the inherent contradiction, right? That like a smile is designed to be like warm and inviting, and it's a universal symbol for friendliness.
Yes, I'm sure this is a question that you get asked in every interview and that you're prepared for, but it's something that is fascinating because it's the same reason a clown is scary.
Exactly. Know? Yeah, and I think that, you know, like, to take something that is supposed to be what our brain is telling us, hey, that's friendly, and turning it into this like, you know, promise of a threat, something menacing and evil and like hateful. You know, I think there's something that it sort of shakes in our core that really freaks us out. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that I think in practicality, we wear smiles as masks all the time, right? So, and you know, I think that whether you're in like an awkward social situation that you're trying to like back away from, whatever, you know, you smile through something like that, or something, you know, much, much heavier. I think we, you know, all of us, you know, sometimes walk around with like grief or trauma or stress or anxiety, these things that we're all carrying around inside of our heads, but like, we don't want to let the outside world in on that stuff. And so I think like a smile can be a mask for those kinds of things, right? That it's sort of, it's hiding what's going on the inside. And I think, you know, that is something I think a lot of people can relate to. And so that felt very, like apropos to the character story that I was telling. And I wanted to see if I could take a smile and like make it an actual mask for the evil in the film.
Well, you mentioned earlier that A Nightmare on Elm Street changed your life because of the inevitability of all of these people's fortunes. And that's very much a theme of the inevitability of when you come in contact with one of the Smilers. Was that a conscious thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, A Nightmare on Elm Street is always swimming around in my brain, certainly. Yeah. But I think, yeah, I look inwards first for when I'm trying to think of like what could be scary. And so, you know, inevitability is something that I kind of love as a framework for something scary. And so I think I'm always trying to find ways to sort of imbue that into the sort of things that go bump in the night in my stories. But it felt right. It felt again like very sort of in line with the motifs and some of the thematics that I was exploring.
The things that gave you chills when you were young.
Yeah, exactly.
So the first time before we get to the theater, how did this suddenly turn into a major studio release on thousands of screens?
Yeah, so we finished shooting like right before days before Thanksgiving 2021, right on schedule.
And just a year ago.
Yeah. And then, you know, got into post. And so, you know, I turned in my director's cut at 10 weeks, which is pretty much standard,
DGA,
right?
Standard. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, and what happens is, you know, you're playing out of Avid and you're having the, you know, people who just spent millions of dollars, sit down. They're like, all right, show us what you did. And, right. Of course it's all like held together with scotch tape and staples and band-aids.
Metaphorically. Yes.
Yeah. And you're,
in the old days it was literally held together. Right?
Yeah. And you're it's a very nerve-wracking experience, doing that. But, we played it and it went over very well for the executives in the theater. And this was when, you know, Paramount Players was still, that's who watched it, was Paramount Players.
Right.
And they were very supportive after that screening. And you know, the vibes were very good. And so the next step is you do your first preview screening, which I think was at either like 12 or 13 weeks.
Right. And where did you preview it?
So we previewed at the Burbank AMC.
Ah, perfect.
Yeah.
And my first movie screened there too.
Yeah. And and so the we're heading towards that, you know, just desperate trying to get more and more done because you're going to show it to random people for the first time, yeah, who are then like going to be given every ability to sort of
eviscerate you.
Yeah, exactly. And all I've heard are like, you know, nightmare stories about test screenings or whatever. So, yeah, you know, it's very nerve wracking. There's a whole other story to be told, but, the like days beforehand, Paramount Players was folded back into Paramount.
Right. The theatrical company. Yeah.
Well, yes. But as far as like, you know, the things that had been made under Players, they were still planning to, you know, Plus was still a thing. There was just, right, sort of like a tightening of the belt at Paramount. And so, unfortunately, all of the executives that were on the film were no longer at the studio.
Ouch.
And I loved all these people. These were fantastic execs they were the ones who made Smile happen, you know.
Yeah, you got the support from these people who made it through.
Yeah. And so I we became this sort of like orphaned movie for a few days, and this is like literally 3 days before our first test screening. And so word comes down, test screening's still on, you're going to go there. And so we go on Tuesday, and we set it up and we play it in front of the audience. And I remember beforehand the sort of like research people, you know, they're like, listen, horror routinely tests, you know, at least 10 points lower than every other genre.
NRG,
Yeah, and they're like, and also like movies with, you know, your sort of thematics and ending like do even worse. So like, they're like, don't worry, everybody's looking at it through that lens. Like, it's going to be fine when the audience hates your movie. Like, you know, which is
now
like,
that's a good setup.
Yeah, not a great boost of confidence. But we go and we play it. And again, you know, I'm 12 or 13 weeks into post. My face is smashed so against it that I have no sense of objectivity whatsoever.
But here you're seeing your movie for the first time with a real audience.
Yeah.
And your first movie for the first time with a real audience. So this sounds like we're about to hear a Cinderella story.
Well, so it's a packed, like, 270-person screening. And the, you know, the movie starts. And, you know, it's the movie's got a little bit of a slow burn to the beginning of it, which is like a very interesting thing to experience in an audience full of people who showed up that maybe thought they were seeing like a new Conjuring kind of movie or something like that. But the it's and by the way, there's no marketing. Nobody knows anything about this movie because there's nothing about it out there in the world.
That was about to change.
And so I remember like we get to the scene with Laura and, you know, she goes into her conniptions. Rose goes to the phone to make the call. And then, you know, score goes quiet. Rose turns around. And that first time that we cut to Laura smiling, this like shockwave went through the audience that was like so loud. And, just from that point, my editor was sitting next to me and he was like, dude, I think we got him. And for the rest of the movie, there was just this like really just intense like electricity in the air in the room. And people were like screaming at the screen. I mean, the way they're interacting with the movie was just, it was like overwhelming.
You had to be getting tearful.
I mean, yeah, I was like so just like what, I couldn't believe that people were responding to it the way they were. And because you're so in it at that point, you're just worried about every little blemish on it and all that stuff. And you just can't look at it holistically at all. We leave the screening. They're filling out all of the stuff, cards, you know, which is happening. They do it on tablets now. So it's all sort of like live, you know, happening. And we're discussing out in the hallway. And, you know, my producers are there. Some executives from the studio are there. And I'm meeting some executives for the first time at this screening who did not know, they had never read the script, didn't know anything about the movie. And the research people come over and they're like, guys, like the movie is like scoring through the ceiling. The scores are coming in very, very high. So everybody's very excited. The next day at the studio, we had this sort of like, we had this, it's funny, they call it sort of a postmortem Zoom.
There you go.
That is, you know, like the research team has taken all the cards and has sort of like built a presentation out of it, right? And we find out like minutes beforehand that like they're like, you know, I think an assistant in like a little black box on the Zoom like gets on. They're like, hi guys, Brian Robbins is going to join the Zoom. And Brian Robbins is, you know, head honcho at Paramount.
Right.
And he gets on and you know, he's got the numbers in his hand. And I can just tell there's a lot of excitement on the Zoom. And so Brian is like, here's what I want to do. I want to take the same cut. I want to put it into another theater immediately. Exact same cut. And I want to test it again. And he's like, I want the heads of, you know, marketing, advertising, and distribution to come and watch it with a real audience. Right. So we're like, okay. And at that point, I'm also like, oh man, like, I don't want to like tempt fate twice with like another test screening, you know?
Right.
Like,
but knows? You've got some confidence from that first one.
A little bit. I think 12 or 13 weeks into post, I don't think I had any confidence because, you know, that's still a very strange place to be. So we do it again. We go to the Santa Monica AMC this time. Same deal. They retest it. It somehow goes up a couple of points.
Wow.
Which, you know, same cut. But like it plays the exact same way in the room. I mean, people are shouting at the screen, like really, really reacting to it in a strong way. And then the next thing that I hear after that is that they're setting up these screenings on the lot for tons of different people, like from Paramount, to come and watch this movie.
Wow.
Because there was like, there was only like a small handful of people that knew that this movie even got made, like sure. that it even existed.
Ah, streaming.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I mean, I think there's a, you know, it's just, I think it's just the siloed nature of things. Like, because sure. there was like, it's not like, there was a lot of care, you know, from everyone who had made it. I mean,
yeah, they weren't dissing it. They exactly, just weren't aware yeah. of it.
It just
yeah.
was, it was a sort of different side of the business. You know, yeah. they'd never had a real, like, you know, P&L sort of talk about this or whatever.
Right.
But so the next thing I sort of hear is that, like, there's all these screenings of it happening, all these meetings about the movie are happening. And we're just like, I'm being told, like, just keep moving forward in post. And so we're working on it. We're working on it. Then I hear, okay, they're having a basically what would have been a green light meeting, like way after the fact, as far like a theatrical green light meeting.
Wow.
And we were in the DI, starting to
doing the digital interface.
Yeah, to color the film. And I got a call and they're like, hey, we want to bring you in to like you and the producers to have a discussion. And we go into Mark Weinstock's office. Mark is the head of marketing at Paramount.
Right.
And they're like, we really like believe in this film and we want to take it wide release theatrical and do a full marketing campaign behind it, which was like, you know, my ears were buzzing. I was trying to understand how I was misinterpreting what was being said to me.
Yeah, this doesn't happen. This doesn't happen. But, you know, and normally our show, we cover careers. But in this case, your career is one feature, but it's an amazing story, which is why we can spend an hour talking about it and still not feel fulfilled.
Yeah, yeah. It was one of those, like, I mean, even getting to make a movie with Paramount was such a dream come true.
But yeah.
Like, for this to have happened was just, like, the most surreal, just, you know, pinch me thing that ever, you know?
And then within moments, the trailer is everywhere.
Well, yeah. So what we had done, so I get this call because we're still working on the movie in the DI, which we were doing at Photochem. And they're like, hey, we have this idea. Like Top Gun comes out next week and we want to put a 30-second like title reveal teaser on Top Gun.
There's another dream come true.
Yeah, which, by the way, Top Gun was like the widest released film ever, I think,
yep.
like domestic release at that point. And so they're like, but we have to think inside the box because like your movie is extremely rated R, but this has to be something that can play in front of a 4-quadrant film. So they came up with that little 30-second idea that basically revealed the title and the concept of the smiling. And what was great was they didn't put it on the internet, right? So that
right.
nobody knew that was coming.
Even better.
And it was funny. I was kind of like looking at like Reddit and some other places, and there were people that were like, "Did I have like a fever dream? Like, what is?" Because they couldn't find anything about the movie
right.
and what it was. And then it was like, you know, a few weeks after that they released the first theatrical trailer,
which you couldn't go to the movies without seeing, no matter what you saw.
Yeah, which was very strange.
How was that feeling when you first went to the movies and saw your trailer there?
So
go to see it, or did you go to a movie and it popped up?
Well, I knew it was going to be there. I mean, so the first movie it was on was The Black Phone, which I was going to go see anyways. But I went, opening night at The Black Phone, and that was the first time that the movie was the trailer was playing theatrically, and It was like, you know, incredible to like, people screamed at the end of the trailer in the theater, which was like, it feels weird to say, but like, I don't ever recall that happening with a trailer in a theater before. And the amount of like chatter afterwards of people talking about it was just like, it was amazing. I mean, it was just surreal. So I went with a buddy and I couldn't believe it. It sort of like blew my mind how much people reacted to the trailer. Yeah. And then suddenly every movie I went to for the rest of the summer, it was on, which probably felt like a lot for some people, but they had a very short window to get the word out about the film.
It worked. I love hearing a Cinderella story, particularly in our genre, and I'm so glad it happened for you.
Oh, thank
so,
you.
I'm sure you've been offered a lot of nutty stuff as well as interesting stuff. What's next for you?
You know, I want to continue to make you know, horror is one of my first loves. I definitely, you know, I love things that are scary or sort of anxiety inducing. I love like movies that make you sweat. Yeah. So I'm always trying to instill that into what I'm doing, but I want to continue to make, you know, genre films that are, you know, a little left of center, that have a real character story, you know, that is the main thing driving them. And you know, whether that's, I'm always going to be writing like original things, but I'm also interested that if there's a way to sort of, just because of, you know, I think the way that the industry works now, I think there can be really interesting opportunities to you know, Trojan horse what ostensibly is an original film inside of the box of IP. You know, that's right. An intriguing concept to me. But, you know, I just want to make sure that I can do things that feel sort of,
well, Parker like Finn movies.
Yeah, sure.
Let's do that. Finian films.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah,
excellent. Well, thanks so much for telling your story. Congratulations on $200 million box office and continuing. And I think it should be on demand when this drops.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. This was incredible, and I'm such a fan, so this was such an exciting experience.
Thank you. It's really been a blast, and I couldn't be happier for you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.